Donnell Boardman is being interviewed by Renee Garalick for an oral history on the perspective of medicine. He is retired as a practicing internist, but is actively involved in research. The interview is taking place at his home on the Acton Common on November 9, 1988. Dr. Boardman is 75 years old. Would you relate how you first arrived in 1946 to practice medicine in Maynard?
Well, it's fairly hard to pinpoint it, but I suspect that with the end of World War II and the end of government service, my wife and I had long thought to move into the Boston rather than the New York area where we had both grown up, because it was academically more favorable, and because you could live in the country and still be close enough to the metropolitan center and the academic center. So we came with four small children. I came first with two runabout children, and we slept our first night here in what was called the old homestead, across from the library, when there was no fire in October, and we slept on the floor in the dining room of a house that I bought before the family ever saw it. And the two children and I had breakfast at Howard Johnson's, a new restaurant in Concord, which just started it up at that time. And mother and Buck's old twins arrived later the next day. We came to Acton because it was in the country, but within striking distance of Boston and Boston medical and academic centers and cultural centers, and because it was beyond the suburban area. There were only 3,200 people in Acton at that time, and there had been since before the revolution. And it was a nice country village with apple trees, apple orchards, and dairy farmers and truck farmers in the community, and a few people who worked in Boston, but not very many. It was our intent to become a small group practice of medicine, hopefully with a consumer or patient-consumer cooperative prepaid medical plan. And as time developed, it turned out that there was a group of two offices, one in Maynard and one in Littleton, and two hospitals, one the Emerson Hospital in Concord and the other what was known as Ashford Boyle Hospital in Boston, part of Boston University. So I was running between two offices and two hospitals, and they were grouped and I was trying to hold them together. But about 4 years later, Dr. Henry Simpson Harvey joined me because he was also looking for country practice near a metropolitan center, and he had other similar interests.
For a time at the beginning, you had started with the United Cooperative Society, I think?
Yes, quite right, okay, that's true. It was largely the presence of the cooperative, a consumer cooperative of groceries and hardware and coal and oil, cooperative society started by the Finns who lived in Maynard while they worked at the American Woolen Company. That cooperative started really because the mill workers found that most of their paycheck provided by the American Woolen Company went back to the American Woolen Company because they had to go get all their things at the company store and other places that took advantage of their sort of isolation. And they got together to develop a cooperative endeavor so that they could control the prices that they had to pay for food and the common household needs. And indeed, they found that it made an enormous difference. And the cooperative society was extremely successful for at least 10 or 20 years after we came in the 1940s. It really died when most of the younger generation of Finns who had any get up and go got up and left. And that left the older people and the diminishing number of Finns and the diminishing number of mill workers as a central core. A lot of people who moved into the area, which included all the towns around mainly, had an intellectual and ideological interest in cooperatives, but they didn't have the tight-knit cohesiveness that was provided by the American Woolen Company and by the Finns. And so it gradually became less and less loyally supported. At the same time, the Stop and Shop and the supermarkets began to move in, and I think the first one was the A&P itself had suffered a casualty, but it moved in, and its prices in Maynard were substantially lower than they were in Concord, if Concord is the nearest the next one, because they were trying to out-compete the cooperative. Well, one thing or another, competition did prove to be too much for the cooperative society, and it succumbed. One of the reasons we came was not only because the cooperative society at that time was looking at seriously and hard at the idea of getting prepaid medical care, but their whole idea of medical economics were very different. And even mine, as an emerging idealistic dreamer, but with four small children, even in 1946, I thought that $8,000 a year was pretty meager for a well-trained physician, but the general manager of the cooperative, which was, I think, by that time $1 million a year proposition, was only $5,000, and so they couldn't see paying a young man anything like that figure. So we never did come to any kind of an agreement, and the prepayment never materialized until some 30 years later.
There were about five doctors in Maynard when you arrived?
Just about, yes. And most of them, with one exception, were significantly older than I. Only one of them had any access to the Edison Hospital. He did not make use of it, so that the medical care provided in Maynard particularly was, shall we say, limited. And for serious illnesses, patients found that they went even beyond Emerson Hospital, they went into Boston, because the local physicians, if they referred them to the Emerson Hospital, were likely to lose their patients to Emerson Hospital-based physicians. even at that time, though, Concord and other towns used Boston at least as much as they used Emerson Hospital. Emerson Hospital itself had an ambiguous reputation with the population. There were some who felt the patients went there and only to die or only prepare to die. And I don't think that was fair, but it was understandable because it was limited by people usually got there too late. But it seemed to me that it was very obvious that Emerson Hospital had tremendous potential, and there was another young physician already in the Concord area who was building up Emerson's reputation, and since he was doing mostly surgery, it seemed appropriate that internal medicine would be a good adjunct, and proved to be
so. Who was the surgeon you're talking about?
Charlie Dustin came in. He was a very competent technician and a very competent businessman, and really did a lot to improve the image of the Emerson Hospital.
Now, when you first started, your office was on Mason Street in Maynard.
Over the A&T. And on damp days, you could move. You were aware of the fact that the A&T destroyed potatoes. And that I shared that shit with Sam Holliper, who was a chairman, who was doing everyday dentistry. And we became good friends.
You had a wide variety of patients?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it was really quite intriguing. We came to the area, as I said, because of the possibility of cooperative food-based medicine. And my interest had led me up to the Boston area because I had some medical school training in Boston under Paul Dudley White, the cardiologist, and a number of others. But I'd also known several other MGH doctors who had been interested in the White Cross, which was the first prepaid group practice, which started just before World War II. And Dr. Edward Young thought that the White Cross itself was a war casualty. All the doctors that were participating were eligible for the service, got pulled out, and there was no one to provide the service, and therefore it fell apart. Interestingly enough, he and Alan Butler and Hugh Carrot and several others were hauled up before the Medical Society in the early 1940s and asked to show course why they shouldn't be thrown out of the Medical Society, because they were practicing in a socialist or almost communist concept of medical practice. They weathered that, but as I said, after that, drain on their doctor's participants yielded to World War II. So that they were quite interested in my coming back into the area with this interest. And so they were very nice and introduced me. Robert de Normandy was an obstetrician who lived in Lincoln and was probably the dean of clinical obstetrics in the greater Boston area at that time. And he did a lot to help introduce me and my credentials to a blue stocking, if you will, population in Concord and Lincoln, so that I garnered a number of families of the cultured, educated, and sophisticated population of those towns, and at the same time it was well known that among Finnish mill workers that I was becoming equally well approved, so that I got started fairly promptly, and my wife and I were, I remember, celebrating our, the first time that we had, I had a day, you know, gross $30. That was a big event.
You were treating patients, but you were also learning about what it meant to be a physician.
Of course. That's why it's called the practice of medicine. It's never perfect, one is always learning, hopefully.
Some of your patients really, I guess, stayed with you. Was it you or one of your patients who said people are as healthy or as sick as they think they are between the years?
Oh, well, that certainly has been an apparent finding. One often finds physically fit people who think they are sick and are thereby crippled. And there are lots of people who have got cruelly disabling diseases or degeneration or loss of physical function, who are nonetheless very wholesome and healthy in their attitudes, and they deal with their difficulties. But it, yes, I feel very strongly that we are really only as sick as we think we are.
You had your share of night calls at the beginning, didn't you?
Night calls, it always seemed to me, were extremely profitable for physicians. If you go, I sort of deplore the loss of house calls in the present day, because it seems that doctors really never get to know their patients. They don't ever go into their home. And in a period of high tech computerized billing and scheduling and stuff, those are all separate the doctor from the real essence of medical practice. What we were saying about how sick we are between the ears is ever so manifest. I remember getting called to see a man who had a fever just outside of the center of town, and he was desperately sick, 103.6 temperature, and his whole body flaming red, and beginning to pustulate. He was a man of his late 20s with chicken pox. He survived, but I learned not only about that, but I learned about his children and about his wife, who turned out to be, at that time, in and out of a sort of schizophrenic behavior. And I learned about how that family lived. It was extraordinary. You go and see people in their homes, and they are very different than they are in the office. And night calls were particularly revealing in that way. I think that medicine has lost a lot because doctors have gotten caught up so much, necessarily perhaps, with high technology, which has been developed by the electronics industry, but to the detriment of their relationship with people and the people. Family constellation, all of which contributes to the illness. Yes, I think house calls and night calls were fascinating. It got a little irksome when you got called by the police to make a house call, and then, as happened to me on one occasion, in response to the police having called me, I was hurrying to the house and had one of the town police cars stop me for speeding. That was really annoying, but usually it was very interesting.
You had made an observation that it becomes more difficult today to identify a doctor who may even be considered a charlatan because of technology and intervening specialists.
There is a very famous caricature cartoon written by the French, drawn by the French artist Daumier. It shows the patient lying in bed with his head swathed in bandages. The doctor standing by the bedside, his doctor's bag open, and the stethoscope drooping out, and the doctor holding a pen, wetting it to his lips, as he writes on the white wall behind the patient his bill for the for his services. He's got a whole lot of things itemized. The point being that the doctor makes his living at the cost of the patient's discomfort. On the other hand, there's no question but what an eye-to-eye and face-to-face confrontation of patient and doctor has disciplinary effect on the doctor's charges or his compassion. If he really finds that what he's asking for hurts the patient because he sees it on his face, then he's able to modify it. The introduction of third-party payments has removed all that. Most people, including the doctors, don't have any idea what the costs are that are being generated in the doctor-patient relationship in the HMO type of practice. And this contributes a lot. On the other hand, the fact that big business has moved in and streamlined and complicated the big business of medical care adds an enormous overhead. You have to pay for the business administrators. The high tech, as I have indicated before, has gotten to be so expensive. Even if you have an expensive diagnostic test machine in your office, you have to use that machine to pay for that machine, and you have to charge the patient for it. And you use it. Sometimes it helps. Sometimes it confirms. Usually, it does no more than to confirm the doctor's decision of the patient does or indeed does not have what the test is supposed to show. It all separates the doctor from the patient. In my mind, that's the essence of medical care and indeed in human relations, one-to-one sharing the responsibility of the patient's malady. If the doctor doesn't encourage the patient to meet his his misfortune and meet his disease with him, then he's going to have less success and perhaps be another failure. And it seems to me that if you enlist the patient's help in his cure, then you have pretty well ensured that patient as a colleague and as a friend and not as an adversary that you're going to meet in court over a medical legal practice.
So therefore you think there would definitely be less malpractice than...
Oh, I don't think there's any question. I've always felt that, generally speaking, a patient that developed medical malpractice has got a basis. There usually is a misadventure in the medical management, irrespective of the fact that the patient also may or may not have had a fatal or a crippling disease. But usually there is a mistake of one sort or another. But the reason it goes to gets to court is because there's also been an alienation between doctor and patient. And this is particularly true in a complex system whereby patients are treated, and I shouldn't say patients are treated, but the disease is treated by a team of doctors, none of whom address themselves to the care of the patient. They're only treating the disease. And the patient and the family very often feel left out, and then they begin to have doubts, and then they begin to ask questions, and then there's always somebody to goad them on and say, yeah, you've got a rough deal. And that, it seems to me, is a major disaster. I might add, though, this is, after all, the common phenomenon in our socioeconomic society. Anyhow, there's very little trust now. You have to have a credit card. The idea of you're going in and saying, I'm me, I've been around and you've been around for 20 years, we know each other, we trust each other, is a thing of the past. It's just, there is just no more a warm, vibrant community, unity, and confidence. And it's very sad, because it lends to the climate of distrust of every aspect of our human relations.
For a while in your career, you seem to be going at a very intensive pace. I think you mentioned to me earlier that you taught at the Boston University School of Medicine, you were at Emerson Hospital, you began to have private practice both in Maynard and in Littleton. Remember those days?
Yeah, I do, yeah. 80 hours a week. Yes, indeed. Yes. It got frenetic, and quite legitimately, my wife and particularly the mother of my children began to complain about not seeing much of father or not seeing much of husband. And Elizabeth was just marvelous because she always felt that it was very important to have me an integral part of the home life. We always had breakfast together, even with two platoon of schooling, which took place in Acton when our children were small. We would have breakfast as a family together, and most unusually, we had dinner together at night. And Elizabeth would tell the children to go on up and do their studies before dinner, because I didn't get home until 7:15, 8:15. I hate to say it, perhaps almost 9:15. But dinner was kept so that we would be together. And it was very easy to get caught up by what Elizabeth always called my mistress. The only mistress that she was willing to yield to. Only one she ever had to compete with. Going from hospital to office to hospital to another office in the town and out got to a point where I finally made a conscious decision. It isn't worth this kind of rush. I decided, even if I was going to be not only late but later, I would take it and lay down things where I had to, so that I could keep going. Well, it worked out very well. After a while, Henry Harvey came.
And what year was that?
He came in 52, I think. And Dr. Bell got in 54. Dr. Harvey came after, and I think stuck around for about 3 or 4 weeks, breaking him into the routine and so forth and so on. When I came back 2 weeks later, he was weary and drawn. He wasn't used to this kind of life. But after that, it picked up for both of us as soon as he arrived, and has grown ever since. As you know, the academic associates now is 14 or 15 doctors. But while I was there, we never got bigger than 6 or 7.
And that was formed in 57?
It really was formed when Aunt Bell joined us in 54. The three of us made, two was a partnership, three qualified for a group or an association.
Mm-hmm.
And we built our building, our first building in 19... paid too much for that piece of property, but I think it's fair to say that it's probably somewhere between 50, valued at 50 to 100 times what we paid for it now. And the building has been expanded, I should say, doubled and then quadrupled in size. So I guess it was pretty frugal and worthwhile business venture.
So you still had private practice?
We felt that group practice was very important, that there should be a free interplay between covering for one another, but that, again, as the group developed, the group was interested, even as I had been interested, in having a personal one-to-one relationship. So we always asked patients to choose one of the doctors to be their personal physician. Or for the family, to be the family physician. That if they over a period of time they wanted to change that, they should feel perfectly free to do so. But there should be a one-to-one relationship. That's survived pretty well, even when there were 5 and 6 members of the group, and we all had our own loyal following. All of them were perfectly willing to accept one or the others. As a replacement for on-call or vacations or holidays and things of that sort. But the always a one-to-one relationship, and that's, as I said, that survived as long as I was there.
And then you also were teaching at Mass General?
Yeah. I joined the staff at BU in 1948, when I was still a solo practitioner, and went in did some outpatient teaching 3 times a week all throughout the school year. And then some 6 or 7 years later, since I was a great advocate of country practice and the practicing tradition in the semi-rural area, having at least a toehold in an academic situation, I wanted to promulgate that, so I went and talked to the dean of Dean Faulkner, Jim Faulkner, at BU School of Medicine, and he was very helpful in encouraging me to start what was called a preceptorship, which we got fourth-year medical students to use one of their elective periods to come out and work with me as preceptor to learn about the clinical practice of medicine in a community. It included industrial medicine, school physician, sports medicine, as well as clinical practice in office, house calls, and hospital. And the first year I tried to introduce this at the Emerson Hospital, there was one member of the staff who was
outraged at their thing and had talked to all the doctors about the ill advisability of doing this, and suggested that I was just using medical students to spy out my colleagues so I could get the advantage of them. And when it came to a vote, Dr. Harvey, and I never was sure that Dr. Harvey didn't think it was advisable to plan it that way, but Dr. Harvey was on a house call and was not there to vote. So the vote turned out to be, I think, 13 to 1. I voted to 1, and there were only 13 others present. Within weeks, the doctors in Boston and in the teaching hospitals all around who had any contact with the Emerson Hospital staff members were asking questions. What happened to Emerson Hospital? Why did you lose such a wonderful opportunity? The next year it got started, and it went for a good 10 years as long as I was at BU. And we really had a fascinating time. Students were very enthusiastic. They proved to be good learners, and they kept not only the members of the Act of Medical Associates, which was growing at the same time, but also the members of the staff at the Emerson Hospital on their toes, and witnessed the fact that even though that preceptorship came to an end, it has since been reestablished by younger members of the Emerson Hospital staff, and I believe they've got an active preceptorship going of one sort or another at Emerson even now. So that I felt it was a good thing, well worth starting.
It certainly was.
Lots of fun. Just lots of fun.
So that initial 10-year period was from about 1953 to 63?
That's right, mm-hmm. Yes.
Now you served on the Emerson staff for 40 years?
Essentially, yes, 46 to 86. I went away for a couple of years in 78 to 80, and then came back and practiced more or less on my own, but under the roof of and with all the support, office and nursing support of the academic associates, but I did not rejoin the associates. So I was there for 40 years.
You're outspoken?
Well, I have to admit that I had a very clear idea, of what practice could be when I came to Emerson. And one of the reasons, as I've indicated, I came to Emerson was because it was in the country, it was close enough to be associated with teaching and academic medicine in the city. And I came as I look back at it, with a good deal of self-assurance and confidence in the idea, and I made it very clear. There wasn't any question in my mind, so that older men who had been well trained, many of them at Harvard, took some exception to my being outspoken and my being ambitious in this way. So that yes, I was quite outspoken, and when I came to the Emerson Hospital, it had I don't think only about 13 beds, or maybe it was 23 beds or something, and it had its laboratory constituted a part-time technician who stopped on his way back home from another hospital laboratory and did the laboratory work for the hospital between 5 and 6:30 in the evening. And Wiley's reaction was, that's not enough. And so I said so. Well, I made a number of other comments, many of which may have touched closer to home. So at the end of the year, chairman of the board of trustees caught me in the corridor of the hospital and asked me whether I thought there was any reason why the board of trustees should reappoint me to be a staff. And I just stopped in the corridor and turned and looked at him and said, can you give me a reason why they shouldn't? he didn't answer, and I don't know what he was looking for when he asked the question, but the question, neither the question nor the appointment ever came under, came up again. And so I continued to having successfully expressed myself and then defended it by, yes, I guess I spoke up of a lot of things. It's interesting, you know. I never did raise questions that were totally unacceptable or unthinkable by my colleague. And usually when I raised an issue that sort of had a startled electric silence after I asked the question, people would come up to me after the meeting broke up and as we walked down the car, "Don, I'm so glad you brought that." I said, "Where were you? I didn't hear you speak up in defense." Well, you know, it has happened over and over again. But it was a good relationship. Of course, once the Act of Medical Associates got established, just the fact that they were there, my partners really didn't have to speak up, because it was known that they were my partners, you see. And I almost never asked any questions at staff meetings without having sort of fielded a sentiment on this subject with my partners, with one or two other people. And the staff really did get to be a lot more liberal and a lot more open as years went by. And within the next 10 years, not only Acton Medical Associates, but lots of new doctors came who were much more receptive to new ideas. And witness the fact that Emerson is now a very impressive, almost tertiary care, top-flight care of practice, and certainly well up into the secondary community hospital care at a time when hospitals are having a rough time. So it's doing, insofar as I've been able to keep up with it, but it seems to be doing very well.
You've observed that most of the decisions you have made in medicine have kept you from getting rich.
six children.
But so much of your concerns have been with, of course, you've had a social conscience and you've gotten into other areas.
Yeah. In and out of jail, I might say.
You didn't tell me that.
on social issues. Yeah, I spent a night in, where was it? Washington, D.C. Sitting on the sidewalk in front of Mr. Nixon, holding him in the light, as the Quakers say. That just so happened to have been the weekend before Washington, D.C. Law and Order was expecting the big demonstration in Washington, which took place. And so I always felt that when they picked up something like 100 Quakers, that Sunday, they did so to serve as a warning to those who were going to come the next week. And of the 100, I guess only about 50 were locked up because we wouldn't offer bail and we were speaking with our body.
As a Quaker, you had made certain decisions during World War II.
Yes. As a matter of fact, you know, there's never been any question in my mind, but what I got sort of special providential care. If World War II had come much earlier, I wouldn't have been as well prepared to provide service to my fellow man, because I wouldn't have completed my formal medical training. If it had come a little bit later, I wouldn't have had the same opportunity to take a position. But most particularly, the fact that I had my postgraduate training in medicine, so that I was fully prepared to take on a job that the government could use, made it perfectly obvious even to the government that it didn't make sense to put me into a citizens, I've forgotten, CCAO classification, CPS, is what it was, citizens, CPS camp, for conscientious objectors to fight fires, forest fires. They could see that they were going to need doctors, whether it was in the military or out of the military. And so they made good use of the fact that I was a qualified doctor. And when I found out through the American Friends Service Committee, this was long before either Elizabeth or I had gotten to become friends, but I learned through our church, through George Buttrick at the Madison Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York, the AFSC was helping conscientious objectors. I got in touch with them and they said, go and ask the Civil Service Commission about the Japanese relocation camps. They were delighted. Most of the doctors they had were really marginal at best. I said, don't misunderstand me. I'm a young man and I recognize that we're in an emergency and I'm ready to go anywhere and do anything and be moved around. And my wife is quite understanding and willing to cooperate. So that we went to be troubleshooter for the War Relocation Authority, which was designed under the Department of the Interior, under Harold Eckes, who was just a delightful person to work under. I mean, he had vision that you could feel it even in the ranks way down where we were in the desert of, in the mud of Arkansas or the desert of Arizona. It was designed to provide the necessaries of medical care to the Japanese Americans and the Japanese born Japanese who had no citizenship that were moved out of the West Coast war zones and put into these camps. The physical insult and hurt was far less than the psychological, the economic, and the social isolation and focus on them just because they were Japanese, of Japanese heritage. But it was devastating to a self-respecting people who had really made their mark and had contributed enormously to the wealth of California, particularly as farmers. They were just very good, industrious people. Well, in the end, it turned out there were 10 camps and I served in 8 of them, or visited, I can't remember, 7 or 8 of them. It was one time I thought I knew more Japanese Americans on a first name basis than most of the Japanese Americans in the country, because I'd been on a first name basis with people from all different kinds of localities. And wherever I went, it was to go to a place of greater urgency and greater need than where I already was, where I was more than busy all the time. So it was a great experience. And I always felt, by far, the most creative way to spend war years for a young man that could be done. I've always felt, both in the World War II, to a lesser extent, I knew less about the Korean War, but the war in Vietnam, I had two sons that were involved with that. And I've always felt that by and large, almost every young man who lives in the country through an era of war is a war victim. They are scarred for life by the experience that they have closely associated with the war. Whether they serve in the military or not, the compromises, the attitudes of mind are so disforming and so warping from a creative, positive, communal way of life that it's devastating. And I felt that this was by far the least injurious way of man. So as I said, I've always felt that I was particularly favored.
And you and your family actually lived in the camps with the...
I went off to the first assignment, leaving her and a new baby, or a year-old baby, behind. And she joined me about three or four months later. And after that, we were discussing this just the other day with this Japanese boy visiting us today. We were talking about how many of the camps she had been to. It turned out she also had been at six. I thought, well, I'd been to a lot more than she had. I only been to two. She didn't ultimately get to see. She did one stretch of teaching in the high school, teaching English to students, one of whom later was a medical school student, and having been taught in high school by my wife, was taught in medical school by me, and several others. There was one president of the class told her that he thought that evacuation of the Japanese was one of the best opportunities of his life. He got him away from just the parochial scene in California, and he was headed off to an Eastern college and so forth and so on. There were those that felt this was a really quite an experience, quite a positive experience. But there were a lot of people who were, particularly the older people, who were much hurt by it, and their confidence, self-confidence, really shattered. So it was a disaster. But it was I'm delighted that even 40 years later, it's been acknowledged ultimately, and they're ostensibly supposed to be given some kind of compensation.
You were there when the atomic bomb was dropped?
Yes. We were in Thule Lake, which is the largest and the last of the camps, and was a camp to which some 5,000 were moved from the other camps preparing to go back to Japan from choice. There were 18,000 in Thule Lake, and we were there for something over a year, the end of the 3.5 years. And my wife was pregnant with twins and had two runabout children, and we got Mrs. Sakurai, that is a Japanese-born woman who knew very little English, but just enough to make do with Elizabeth's help to communicate with one another, to help Elizabeth, and then August 5th came, and train came down the track toward the camp, down the valley, blowing its whistle until all its steam ran out, and the whistle just drooped out and died, and the news came almost instantaneously from up in the camp that Hiroshima had been bombed. And Elizabeth turned to Mrs. Sakurai and said, "Mrs. Sakurai, don't you come from Hiroshima?" And she said, "Yes, I do." And Elizabeth said, "You have family?" She said, "Two sons and all my parents and all my brothers and sisters, and Elizabeth said, "Oh, dear, perhaps you should go home and be with your family, your husband and the children that are here." She said, "No, I take care of the children." Then she got the twins had been born, and so she got all four of the children cleaned up and put away, and then she said, "Perhaps I go home." And it took time for everybody to begin to understand the full implications of this. And it was a sorry time. But Mrs. Sakurai was released because the war was over and went back to Sacramento. And a good friend of hers who stayed in camp working with another family came and checked in on Mrs. Boardman and her four babies. And she looked around and she said, "You can't do this. You need Mrs. Sakurai." "I said my daughter." And she sent her daughter to look for her. "Where do I find her?" "Look on Third Street." Mm-hmm. But she said, "There are a lot of..." She said, "Walk in the middle of the street and shout." So Mrs. Sakurai came back, and much to the surprise of the military police, who sent word, "There's a Jap out here who says she just got out of the camp and now she wants to come back in. Is that all right?" So my wife went out and said that yes, she's coming back to help me. So that was our first intimate association and the first concern we had with ionized radiation and the nuclear bomb and nuclear, all that sort of thing.
Was her family safe?
To my knowledge, they lived in the center of Hiroshima. We never heard a word. Very little was known about the true dimensions of that thing for 5 years. Nothing came out of the military clamped secrecy the next day.
So you never knew their fate?
We never knew their fate. We assumed, of course, that Mrs. Sakurai lost all her family and her two sons. Mm-hmm. But we never knew.
When you quote retired from active practice in 1980, you also offered your services, medical services in Africa.
Yeah, we one thing or another led to our becoming Quakers in the late 50s. Oh. We didn't become Quakers until after the Korean War, because I didn't want any question about the Selected Service Board about just joining a peace church to avoid the draft. And you see, the doctors were called up. It's a special doctor's draft for the Korean War. So, anticipating that, we did not. I got called up and submitted conscientious objection plea, in which I sent a copy of what I'd written 10 years earlier, and said nothing has happened in the intervening 10 years to do more than to confirm my opinion. And so they wrote back and classified me as too old to fight. After that we joined the Friends. Then through the Friends we learned about the Quaker Mission Hospital in Kenya. I don't really know why it seemed like such a good idea to both me and my wife to go. They had a doctor that was finishing up and two other doctors that were going 3 months later. And I said it was obvious they needed some kind of liaison. So I volunteered, went, had a splendid time. And enjoyed it very so much, and I kept talking about it, so that when I got to be 65, my wife thought that would be a good way for me to get out in front of the from the Acton Medical Associates, given my temperament, she thought that it was unlikely that I could truly retire from the active participation, staying there, and I agreed, so we went off for 2 years.
Currently, you're studying molecular radiation.
Yes. When we came back from Africa, the physicians, the social responsibility was being reactivated by Helen Caldicott, the Australian pediatrician at the Children's Hospital, who had been concerned with the uranium miners in Australia and the implications for damaging people anywhere along the line in the use of radioactive isotopes. And she had come to this country because this is where, well, I don't know whether she came, she and her husband both came into teaching positions, but she became very much concerned with nuclear energy, as indeed a lot of people were. And the atomic veterans had just come to recognize themselves after a 25-year silence having been placed upon them. They were just beginning to be aware of the fact that they had been exposed, and that many of them, who had no connection with one another because there were very little buddy activity generated or encouraged among atomic veterans, began to recognize that they were a marked group. And it became increasingly apparent that these men had had more exposure than was officially acknowledged, and that they were sicker than they should be, and their sicknesses didn't fit any category that the new Veterans Administration was going to recognize as compensable, as service-connected. And then it became increasingly apparent that these men didn't really have the kind of disorders, at least some of them didn't have the kind of disorders that other people have. Now, again, here's where time makes a lot of difference. Had I been a young physician, I wouldn't have been so secure about being able to tell the difference between malingering or psychoneurotic or opportunistic complaints. But you know, after 40 years in a mill town, you really do begin to know how to tell what's real disease and what's imagined disease and what's feigned disease. And it was very clear that, as you reviewed, and I've reviewed close to a couple of hundred by now, medical records, that many of these men had an exposure to ionizing radiation of sufficient and significant degree so that they were sure that they'd been exposed, but not enough for them to have had a recognized and officially acknowledged diagnosis of acute radiation sickness. Many times they would go to see the doctor in the VA or on duty in the military service or subsequently in civilian life, and the doctor would say, well, you had a radiation sickness. But then when push came to shove, it turned out that the record said that the guy had too much sunburn and too much beer. That's why he got the skin rash, and that's why he got nausea and vomiting and bloody diarrhea.
So never showed up on the official record.
So the official records, more often than not, never had it. And over again, you'd find that the guy who knew all his buddies and had pictures of where he'd been on the Nevada test sites would write in, and there would be no record of his ever having been there until he pushed and pushed, and finally he got his lawyer to write a FOIA letter, a Freedom of Information Act letter,
And then they'd say, oh yes, he was there. And then after a while they said, well, our records got burned up in St. Louis, and our records are lost, mislaid, or incomplete. So we will accept any veteran's assertion that he was there on face value if we don't find the records to the contrary. But then it became apparent that these guys were sick, and you couldn't really identify, or they couldn't identify, what their major difficulty was, except that they'd never felt quite up to what they should be. Well, there are lots of malingerers, you know, constitutionally inadequate people who are never able to face life. This was different. These guys had specific complaints, and later you could find objective physical findings that didn't fit other categories of disease. And this has become so apparent in so many of the records that I've called this a typically atypical syndrome, or a typically atypical sickness. And I think that probably 10% of the hundreds of cases that I have reviewed closely and have reviewed in general with other people who are concerned with this problem have this syndrome, and it is almost surely got to do with the nature of ionizing radiation, which does not hit this organ or that organ or this part of the body or that part of the body, but will go through the body and hit at random anyone, any molecule in any chemical constituent of any part of the cell. And the cell is a great big thing, as big as the human being, when you can start thinking in terms of molecules. There are billions of molecules in just the chromosome, you see. And the chromosome is only a small part of the nucleus, and the nucleus is only a small part of the cell. And the cell is made up of all sorts of complex things, each of which are made up of molecules, which have got hundreds of thousands of atoms in them, and each of the atoms has a number of circulating electrons, and ionizing radiation pings off these electrons in these atoms, in these molecules, in these different organelles, fragments of the cell, and the guy just doesn't feel right. It may kill the cell, and then it gets replaced with fibrous tissue, or it may change the protein that makes other proteins, makes other enzymes, and they're all a little bit off. So he doesn't know what's going to happen. And if you look, you find that this does actually happen at very, very, very low levels of ionizing radiation. Most of the x-rays that we have taken, chest x-rays, diagnostic x-rays, are measured in thousands of electron volts. And if you take a series of them, you just multiply that in office. It only takes 20 electron volts. That is thousands less, 1,000th of that much electron, to disrupt any organic bonding molecule, so that you can disrupt things with very small amounts. Mm-hmm. And then it gets more and more complicated, but this has been a problem as I have seen it, and I came at it, being a clinician, I came at it from a clinical aspect, and I came at it from hearing men tell their stories about what has happened to them. To put their stories together and in a cause and effect relationship to something that happened to them 35 years ago is impossible. And that's what's been known as the doctor's dilemma, you see. But if you see these stories and you see these patterns of disorder happening over and over again, and you recognize it on a molecular and a physical chemical basis, that's the way radiation works, then not only justifies it, but it explains why it's the way it is. And that's where we're at the present time. But this has all been complicated by the fact that since Hiroshima, the day after Hiroshima, everything to do with the human hazards of ionizing radiation has been relegated to the Department of Energy, who was originally the Atomic Energy Commission and the military, but now under the Department of Energy, and 27 national radiation laboratories, and what are known as the Oak Ridge Associated Universities. Oak Ridge, Tennessee is one of the major radiation facilities, government run. And the 80 Oak Ridge Associated Universities are the key universities throughout the country that have big nuclear nuclear physics facilities, and they are all very well dominated by men who understand what shall and what shall not be disseminated for general consumption. You go to the government documents catalog, and everything that you get out there is stamped, cleared for unlimited distribution, which means there are other things that are not cleared. So la sondeur, as we French say. It goes without saying. So that I am persuaded, having spent a lot of time studying how radiation works in biologic tissues, and particularly in human tissues, I am persuaded, and there are a number of very good scientists and health physicists and physicians who are equally assured that this is indeed a fact, and that we have absolutely no idea of the degree to which damage is being done. I'm not saying it is absolutely destructive, I'm just saying the evidence is it is far more destructive than the general public has been allowed to believe.
Okay.
So that's what I'm doing right now.
You have also been involved with an effort to deal with the local drug problem.
That must be 20 years ago, almost 20 years ago. When the kids, the high school kids, some of their out of high school colleagues used to meet right here across the street on the common, in front of the town hall, and one night one of the young people that I knew very well shouted, "Dr. Boardman," right from the monument out here, and called because there was one of his buddies was over there with an OD, an overdose I guess it must have been heroin, because he had a respiratory arrest. They got the EMT, and the EMT gave him artificial resuscitation and took him off to the hospital. But it was as blatant as that, the teenagers collecting night after night out here in front of the town and exchanging and smoking a lot of pot and so forth and so on. Two of the other doctors, the younger doctors, the acting medical associates, Jim Longhope, who is now a psychiatrist on the staff at Emerson, and Bob Schumacher, who was a pediatrician who went out into the Indian service for a while and then came back and founded pediatric practice in New Hampshire now, got together with some of these young people who we knew as patients and as contemporaries of some of my children. Well, my children had by this time moved on in a way that... we had a group which met, we had about 25 enlisted people who came every Tuesday evening to talk about the drug problem. And I've always thought it would be a good idea for us to do a follow-up. That's right, because when I came back from Africa, I talked to Jim Longhope, and he suggested that I had more time than he, and we should do a 10-year follow-up. So that would take it back to the early 70s, 68 to 70. That's right. That's what it was. With 25 that we knew of, the general agreement was that there were at least 50 mainline shooters, heroin, intravenous heroin users, in our community. That included Concord, and I don't know how far beyond Concord, Acton, and Maynard. But we figured at that time that 50 hard drug users in a community of a few thousand represented a higher incidence of heroin addicts in our community than was reported in New York City. And that made us sit up and take notice. And so we started talking about it and talked to these guys and talked about how useless it was and what a dead-end track it was on. We never felt, the three of us, three doctors, never felt that we really had much impact other than we represented the established community who was willing to talk and listen and appreciate them as individual human beings. Who's to say whether that had any effect? All I can say is that at least one of them got on the methadone and became a lawyer. Another one has been in and out of rehabilitation things for the next 10 or 20 years. One turns up every now and then and reports to me on some of the others. And gather that, to my knowledge, none of them are dead yet. But, here it is, 89, it's almost another 10 years. It was almost 20 years. I got the feeling, one of them really kicked the habit entirely and became a laboratory supervisor at one of the teaching hospitals in Boston. And his sister also was able to kick the habit. So some of them got off of it, some of them are still struggling with it, some of them are lost to view. I'm not sure of how many are dead. When I came back from Africa, it was 10 years from this group, of the Tuesday evening group, I asked around and they asked whether the drugs were any less, and those that were that were in the know, in the medical field, said, on the contrary, it's probably much worse than it's much more undercover, and it's much younger group. And I never undertook to get involved with it again. Perhaps I should have, perhaps somebody else should be getting involved again. But you want to wrap it up. I guess I would say the older I get, the later it gets in the century, the longer I watch the common scene, the more impressed I am with the general lack of interpersonal communication and inter-human compassionate awareness we have for one another, not only in medicine, not only in nuclear energy, not only in the high-tech modern medical management, but in every aspect of human endeavor. I think we are in very precarious times. And I don't believe I'm alone. Bill Moyer has been having people provide a world of ideas near midnight for the last month. Everything those people have said sounds very familiar to me, and really
very ominous. Of course, we all end up on a note of hope. It's got to be better. It's too good to be over with. But it seems to me that Albert Einstein was speaking far more profoundly than people have ever understood when he said, we have got to change our way of thinking. We've got to change our way of thinking, our way of feeling, our way of interrelating, our way of caring not only for one another, but for the earth itself, and for everything that it stands for. We are making absolutely obscene clutter of the cosmic surroundings of the earth, filling it with radioactive satellites so it's beginning to look like a used car lot. And we do it with an absolutely pre-adolescent arrogance of ignorance, of not being, having any sense of responsibility of what we are doing in a very real way to potentially upsetting the total cosmic relationship of this single isolated globe. And I feel that this is truly disastrous. And I think, I honestly believe and want to live to see whether humanity can change its way by the turn of the century. I think the year 2000, between here and there, is very, very precarious. That if we make it to the year 2000, we will have made such compromises with our arrogance that we'll bumble along for another 3,000 years. But I think between here and there is very, very questionable. And I just think that you could do anything to get people to stop long enough to really get a look. And why I'm particularly interested in this radiation thing is because it goes from 10 to the minus 20 to the 10 to the 20th power, you know, 10 with superscribed minus 10 or plus 10 or the minus 20 or what, because it's the whole expanse and they are all totally integrated in the cosmic plan. If that's theologic or if that's scientific, I don't know. But it's very clear that it's all closely integrated, interrelated, and that only humanity has the possibility of really significantly disrupting a glorious and wonderful plan.
Let us conclude on one of the hallmark breakthroughs at Emerson Hospital with your remembrances of the coronary care unit that was introduced.
Oh, that was really, really quite exciting. I spent a lot of time in the cardiac outpatient department at the Boston University School of Medicine, as well as working in the medical clinic, and was much interested in taking care of cardiac patients along with Jim Hitchcock at Emerson Hospital. And I had been doing electrocardiography ever since I got in. I was studying at Mass General as a medical student. And I got called to see a patient in Boxborough who had an acute ventricular fibrillation and a son who was a fireman and therefore a new EMT and had learned something about cardiac pulmonary resuscitation. And I walked in and found that he was giving his mother mouth-to-mouth breathing and then the external cardiac massage, and that she was so warm and active. And so we put her into an ambulance with him, and he continued and got her to the Emerson Hospital with me following, having called. We were met by Seymour Damari and Charlie Keeble and one or two others whom I don't remember, and to make a long story short, she got to the operating, into the surgical operating room, because at that time it was not clear in the literature or in the discussion of cardiology whether external cardiac massage was better than internal cardiac massage, while they were trying to correct the arrhythmia. And when she got up there, she was given oxygen instead of gas by Ambu Bag, and she recovered so much that she resisted the things that were being done to her and reached up and tried to pull the bag off. Well, she only survived a matter of an hour or two, but it was long enough for five or six of the key members of the Emerson Hospital staff to recognize that here was a woman who had been carried 3 or 4 hours, 2 or 3 hours, and 20 miles, and was in a position to complain about her treatment after all that. And that precipitated the decision on the part of everybody that Emerson Hospital was ready for a coronary care unit. And with Pat Snow and some of the nurses in the special wing on the east wing, we designed cutting windows and mirrors to make an intensive care unit where the nurses could sit and see each of six beds from where she sat. And then we got an American optical oscilloscope for cardiac monitoring for these patients, and we were in business. And Charlie Keeble wrote it all up, and it was one of the key features of Emerson Hospital's contribution to community health care.
Thank you.